Good morning, everyone. My name is Chad Meredith. I'm here this morning to introduce our moderator, Judge Tappar, a man who likely needs no introduction among this group, but they asked me to do it, so I'll do it anyway. You're all aware that Judge Tappar serves on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Before that, he was a district judge in the Eastern Kentucky from beginning in 2008. Yours truly clerked for him from 2008 to 2009, a period that I've heard some refer to as the golden era of the Eastern District. Judge Tappar earned his bachelor's degree from Boston College, his JD from University of California Berkeley School of Law, and clerked for Judge Arthur Spiegel on the Southern District of Ohio and Judge Nathaniel Jones on the Sixth Circuit before entering private practice and then becoming an AUSA and then embarking on his judicial career. There's very little else I need to say because everyone here is familiar with Judge Tappar, but I will say that he is a friend and mentor to many, a role model for all, and one heck of a good judge. So please join me in welcoming Judge Amul Tappar.
Thank you very much. I'm going to give brief introductions of each of the panelists because you can find their bios on the FedSoc website, and there's no reason to waste time with something you can find pretty easily. We'd rather hear from them. So, Judge Danny Reeves, I'm going to just give an interesting fact or two about each of them. Danny's a good friend of mine. We were judges together. But the best fact about Danny Reeves is he's one of the few people in America who was nominated by Presidents Bush, Obama, and Trump to different positions. Presidents Obama and Trump to the Sentencing Commission, and of course, President Bush to the bench. He served on the Sentencing Commission for a long time, but the things he's proudest of are being a grandfather, not a father, the grandfather part, as his kids will tell you. And he is also was an avid golfer. I think his grandkids probably take up too much of his time now, his free time. Elaine Lenhard, I'm proud to have said, was someone I hired to the United States Attorney's Office. And you realize you don't figure out till many years later if your hires are good ones. And one of the things is, do they make a lasting impact on the office and take on leadership positions, which means they're committed to the mission, and Elaine has done both of those things. In addition, she's a proud parent of two daughters, and like me, she sent her kids to Catholic schools in Northern Kentucky. Russell Coleman is now at a law firm. I made a bad decision in not hiring Russell, but he applied for and got a much better job as U.S. attorney just to show me that I make many bad decisions, as my clerks like Phil often remind me. Chad's more politically correct and does not tell me that I make bad decisions. But Russell and I are good friends, and we've spent a lot of free time together talking about things as wide-ranging as raising kids, the best interests of the Commonwealth, and the Bible itself. So Russell's a dear friend of mine. My final friend here, and I know each of these people individually, maybe that's why they put me on the panel, is Jesse Barrett. One of the interesting things about Jesse is before I got to know him well, I litigated a case against him, or our office did, at the United States Attorney's Office. And when it got to appeal, where he was convinced he was going to whip us, he hired two somewhat young whippersnappers, John Nalbandian and Chad Radler, to help handle the appeal. They ultimately became my colleagues. The other thing about Jesse is he's a proud fan of Notre Dame football, where he went to school, and bourbon, which brings him his ties to Kentucky. So after this, he's going to go home, get four of his kids, and drive to South Bend, Indiana. Upon completing that drive, I am sure he will need plenty of Kentucky's finest bourbon. So with that said, I'll start. And the order I'm going to go in is I'm going to start with Judge Reeves and then go to Russell Coleman. After that, Elaine's going to speak, and then we'll finish to my closest, Jesse Barrett. Judge Reeves?
Well, it's good to see everyone. We're going to try to put a little bit of meat on the bone today in talking about some matters, reform, criminal justice reform, and I would probably characterize my remarks as does reform increase recidivism? So I'll try to give you some information, some statistical and other information, primarily from the Sentencing Commission. I do have the authorities that I'll be citing from, so if anyone wants the authority, you can come up afterwards and I'll certainly give that to you. In at the time the Sentencing Reform Act was passed in 1984, the Sentencing Commission began studying recidivism. It's been central to the Commission's work since that time. And recidivism is just simply the likelihood of a person relapsing into criminal behavior after the person has been sentenced or punished. And so with that, the Sentencing Commission over the years has authored a number of articles, one in March of 2016 that's entitled Recidivism Among Federal Offenders, a Comprehensive Overview. And if you've ever practiced in my court before me, you've probably heard me mention this report quite a few times. The Commission studied over 25,000 offenders that were released in 2005 over an eight-year period of time, and it found that 49.3% were rearrested of a new crime or for a violation of supervision during that eight-year period. Keep that number in mind, 49.3%. It becomes important later. The best predictor of recidivism is criminal history. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We do know that as criminal history increases, so does the likelihood of rearrest. If we look at people with zero criminal history points, and I'll talk about criminal history points in just a moment, they have about a 30% likelihood of recidivism. As we get up to individuals with 10 or more criminal history points, that number increases to over 80%. Age is also a strong indicator of recidivism. The younger a person is, the higher likelihood of recidivism that there is. It starts at, if we look at 21-year-olds, they have about a 71% chance of recidivism. If we take that up to 60-year-olds, it goes down to about 14%. Now, what are criminal history points? Well, in the federal system, We know in the federal system, when we look at criminal history points, it's based primarily upon the length that a person is sentenced, and so a lot of criminal history points are determined based upon state convictions. But criminal history points are assigned 1, 2, or 3 points based upon the length of the sentence, primarily. There's some other factors as well. But as we consider criminal justice reform, we need to define really what we're talking about. What is reform? Is it reducing the number of individuals that are prosecuted? Is it increasing the number of individuals released from prison before their sentences would otherwise expire? Is it releasing certain classes of individuals from incarceration, either due to the type of the offense or because of certain demographic characteristics? But if you define it in any of these ways, I suggest to you that reform is not new. It's not something that's just started in the past 18 months. It's taken place for some time now, so let me give you some statistics. Federal prosecutions have been declining over the past decade. In 2011, there were 86,201 persons prosecuted by the federal government. That number declined to 64,565 this past year. That amounts to a 25% decrease. And it's not something that's related to COVID. It's, you look at the statistics, it's a steady decline. However, while there have been declines in federal prosecutions, there have also been actions taken by the executive branch that have increased those numbers. For example, in 2013, then Attorney General Holder announced the executive branch's Smart on Crime initiative. In a 2013 memo to U.S. attorneys, General Holder directed a change in policy in charging and prosecuting drug cases. The goal was to ensure that mandatory minimum penalties were reserved for the, quote, serious, high-level, or violent drug traffickers. He indicated that mandatory minimums had resulted in unduly harsh sentences and perceived disparities that did not reflect our principles. The Attorney General went on to outline certain criteria that were to be followed by prosecutors, and one factor was that mandatory minimums not be charged if the defendant did not have a, quote, significant criminal history, which he defined normally as three or more criminal history points. Now, in 2014, in April of 2014, the Department of Justice furthered the initiative to encourage prison inmates to petition to have their sentences commuted by then President Obama. And although the 2014 Clemency Initiative was originally applicable to all federal prisoners, it was later limited to just those that were serving drug offenses. Over 24,000 petitioned for clemency. They didn't all get the word that this was limited to drug offenders, and clemency was granted to 1,696 individuals under the initiative. Now, while there were certain factors that were announced for qualification, about 5% of those that were granted clemency actually met those factors. The applications that were granted resulted in sentence reductions of about 39% for an average sentence reduction of 140 months. And with regard to the demographics of those receiving clemency, 94% were male, 71% were black, 19% white, and approximately 9% Hispanic. The drug types that for those convicted that primarily resulted in clemency, crack cocaine had 61% of the cases, followed by methamphetamine with 17 and powder cocaine with 15. Now, using the Attorney General's definition from his 2013 memo, 86% of the clemency initiative recipients had a significant criminal history. Nearly a third had 10 or more criminal history points. In fact, almost half were in the highest criminal history category of 6. And of that group, 84.5% were found to be career offenders by the sentencing court. Now, as these initiatives and reforms were being implemented, the population of inmates in federal prisons was declining rapidly as well. In fact, from 2014 to October of this year, the population in federal prisons declined about 27%, from a little over 214,000 in 2014 to 156,000 just this past 2 weeks ago. But in response to various groups and individuals, Congress and then President Trump instituted further legislative reforms regarding mandatory minimums and recidivism penalties regarding the U.S. Code as it concerns drug offenses and other offenses as well. There are certain drug offenses, as you probably know, that carry mandatory minimums of 5 years and 10 years, and there's been a real push among various groups to either eliminate or to make it more difficult to for courts to impose those penalties. But there was one particular statutory provision that was changed that I think may have some impact as we go forward. There's a provision of the code, it's Title 18, Section 3553F. It's called a safety valve provision. It allows individuals that have very limited criminal history and meet certain other qualifications, such as the person can't be must be a low-level offender, they can't possess a weapon, they can't be an injury that results, and they must provide all the information that they have about their offense to the prosecutor prior to the time of sentencing. Historically, you could only qualify for the safety valve that allowed the court to eliminate the mandatory minimum penalty if you had one criminal history point, one or zero. In 2018, as part of the First Step Act, Congress changed that provision to allow many more criminal history points. As a matter of fact, you can have up to 10 points and qualify. That would place you in criminal history category 5. And so the percentage of individuals that are qualifying or that would qualify under the First Step Act, that number of likelihood of recidivism is going to move from 30% up to perhaps 75% or greater. Now, not everyone that has 10 points would qualify, but it does create a sea change. While I was serving on the Sentencing Commission, we had a lot of groups that were interested in changing those points to allow the safety valve to be applied for the guidelines that perhaps had 2 points or as much as 3 points that did not have, as Attorney General Holder said, significant criminal history. That number has now been abolished. Now, why does it matter? Let me just conclude my remarks with two other studies from the Sentencing Commission. The first is from an April 2020 report entitled Length of Incarceration and Recidivism, and the second is an article that was published in September of this year. In the 2020 report, the Sentencing Commission concluded that as sentencing length increases, that is, sentences greater than 60 months or 120 months, the likelihood of recidivism goes down, it decreases. There's a direct correlation. It has a deterrent rather than a criminologistic effect. The latter report, the report from September of this year, is entitled Recidivism of Federal Offenders Released in 2010. And like that earlier report, it compares offenders released that were released in 2005. It compares those that same group of offenders that were released in 2010. And it concluded that the percentage of individuals rearrested for either new offenses or for violations of supervision, 49.3%, the exact percentage from the earlier report. Now, why is that important? It's important in part because in 2009, the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts changed some of the practices that were followed with regard to supervision of offenders. They adopted what they called new evidence-based practices to move money to probation officers to allow those individuals to be targeted that were likely to reoffend. If you look at these two reports together, you could conclude that it didn't work, that the same group of individuals, percentage-wise, was reoffending. And when we look at, and finally, the last point that I'll make on this is as we look at those two factors that I mentioned earlier, criminal history and age of offenders, we look at this largest group that's just been studied. I think over 30,000, 35,000 offenders that were studied over an 8-year period. And we only look at those young offenders, the 21-year-olds or younger, and we only look at those with that are in criminal history category 6, what percentage would you think reoffended? 100%. So when we look at recidivism and we look at individuals that are being released with lengthy criminal histories, you can probably take some of this statistical information and conclude that recidivism of those will see likely increases as opposed to decreases. Judge Lepar.
Thank you. Russell.
Thank you, Judge. And I think we've seen the level of expertise that's brought by our colleague here to the Sentencing Commission. We're fortunate to have had him in that role for a number of years. Prime Minister Churchill is not a fan of thank yous at the beginning of any remarks. In fact, he says opening amenities are oftentimes inanities. So he's extremely critical of any speaker that spends what he calls prime real estate at the beginning of their remarks, giving thank yous. So I'm going to violate that because I do think it's extremely important as we sit in this amazing venue and have our conversations that we belong and participate in an organization that encourages dialogue, that encourages discussion amongst differing opinions. And while most of us are conservatives, whether you participate in Louisville's Federalist Society event, we're frequently we'll have speakers who share a different view, not straw dogs, but share a different view and have a respectful dialogue. That's what we do in this organization. And so I just want to pause and thank the Federalist Society from April Weinberg and her efforts to Bob McBride and organizing this panel and his efforts in Northern Kentucky to just remark on what an incredible organization this is. And we must continue to have these respectful dialogues, because in this postmodernist age where there's a unilateral orthodoxy, it doesn't happen much. There aren't many venues that allow for that. So I'm grateful for the organization. Secondly, I do think it's important. We have an incredible federal judiciary, both in, I think this is the Eastern District. I've heard of this district, Judge, but and in the West.
Loosely connected.
Loosely. And in the Western District. And that is largely a product of our United States senators, and it is largely a product of Senator McConnell and his team and their engagement in bringing the bench that we have. And so I want to pause and We're honored to have Senator McConnell's state director, Robin Taylor, who's been in that role for a number of years. So if you have an opportunity, say hello to Robin. And I'm grateful that she's here on behalf of Senator McConnell. Very much agree, and if there's one takeaway from my brief remarks, very much agree with the judge's comment that our starting point for examining criminal justice reform and our ending point needs to be recidivism. It needs to be what impacts public safety. Because, and I'm looking at it, I'm seeing a number of prosecutors, I'm seeing folks who have served in law enforcement. At the end of the day, recidivism is one of those terms that are thrown around in chambers like this or in beautiful courtrooms. But for those of us who have served in law enforcement, for those of us who are prosecutors, recidivism means people are harmed. Recidivism means we have a larger number of victims. Recidivism is a word that on the street has a dramatic impact. So as we look at criminal justice reform, Judge Beaton and I were joking on the way in that I wanted to reference Potter Stewart. As we look at criminal justice reform, very broad term. You know it when you see it. Let's be very careful and be very specific in what we're talking about, because criminal justice reform runs the gamut. So it is a very broad term, from far left approaches that make us less safe to approaches, some of which at the state level have emanated from this room in the chamber at the other end of the Capitol, that looked at reentry, that looked at expungement, that looked at taking steps that the data shows us reduces recidivism at the state level. So the data shows that we have taken over the last few years some steps that have a positive reduction on recidivism. But you look at other states, and particularly New York comes to mind, and some of their bail reform that have made people who live in New York much less safe. Much less safe. So let's be very careful when we're talking about criminal justice reform and what specifically are we talking about. And I want to mention two examples of that. The first emanates from a sense of failure, because as U.S. attorney, it didn't take a rocket scientist, fortunately, and I appreciate Judge Tappar highlighting the merit-based process for hiring assistant U.S. attorneys versus the political process of hiring U.S. attorneys. You'll see very quickly with my colleague, the AUSA on my left, that the merit-based process does work out, given the caliber of those that Attorney General Sessions, my old boss, called the coin of the realm, those that serve us as assistant United States attorneys. And we are very blessed, both in this district and the West, by those that serve in those roles. A sense of failure, because it didn't take a rocket scientist to be U.S. attorney for a district that includes Louisville, a city that endured 110% increase in violent crime from 2014 to 2016, to know what I needed to focus on and what our office's priority needed to be. And so we leaned in, and I say we, so proud of the assistant U.S. attorneys in the West, working with ATF, working with our state and a number of local partners to increase federal firearm prosecutions. What is the tool that could be most impactful? We're working long-term drug cases. We're working going after these drug trafficking organizations, but that takes time. We looked at the RICO statute and how that could impact some of our gang-driven violence, because in Louisville, the violence is gang and group-driven. So what's the tool, that old blue-collar tool in our toolkit? We went after the trigger pullers. And over a two-year period, we increased federal firearm prosecutions almost 70%, 67%, and we were proud of that. And so at the end, it seems like another era ago, at the end of 2019, I stood at a podium, flags behind us, with our Commonwealth's attorney, with our federal partners, and praised the work that increased federal firearms prosecutions in Louisville, almost 70%. But we still failed, because you may recall, those of you from Louisville or those of you who monitor what goes on in our state's largest city, we still had 93 homicides that year. Louisville was a city that traditionally, and every loss is to be mourned, but Louisville 10 years ago was a city that typically had between 40 and 50 murders a year. Just 10 years ago, 40 to 50 murders a year. And yes, we mourn every one of those, but at the end of 2019, we had almost 100 homicides. So we were leaning into the tool that we thought would be most impactful, but it wasn't working. So humbly tried to look at what was working elsewhere, particularly in regard to violent crime. And I'm not going to leave you with much homework, but some of you all have read this. Many of you all, I would encourage everyone to read a book called Don't Shoot. It's by David Kennedy, a professor at John Jay. And what David Kennedy was responsible for is what's known as the Boston Miracle. A couple of decades ago, Boston was underwater with violent crime. And in concert with the Department of Justice and state and local partners, he developed what's known as group violence intervention. It's a technique that has worked dramatically to reduce violent crime. And we have data for almost 30 years. Reduction in violent crime in Boston by 50%. And again, I'm gonna talk some numbers here, and those numbers can be impactful when we sit in a chamber like this. But when we talk about reducing homicides by 50%, those are fellow Kentuckians that aren't dead. Those are families that aren't enduring significant loss. So although those numbers can wash over us, they mean something. So when you can reduce homicides by 50% effectively over a prolonged period, not a flash in the pan, I wanted to look at that. So we started a conversation with this professor, long hair, northeastern accent, seldom wears a tie, looks very different than most of those staring back at me or what stares back at me when I look in a mirror, but brought something to Louisville, came to Louisville and started a conversation with us about how this technique could work in Louisville. And I would include that in this broad category of criminal justice reform. It has a significant enforcement piece. What it does, it's a painful acronym, GVI, Group Violence Intervention, but it concedes, and the data shows us this, that in a city like Louisville or Boston or Chicago, that these homicides that we're enduring now, and we're going to get into what's going on in Louisville briefly in a moment, are driven by a group dynamic, a gang, a crew dynamic. There's a retributive nature to much of this violence. That there actually is a small number of people that commit these very violent acts. These neighborhoods are not inherently bad neighborhoods. Good folks live there. Very small number of folks are committing a vast amount of this violence, and that there is a group dynamic. And so here's where criminal justice reform for some of us can be a bit challenging, and you have to dig in, because it requires conceding that we have over-policed in these neighborhoods, but we have under-protected. That we have over-policed but under-protected. And that comes from conversations with those that live in these neighborhoods and that are enduring much of this violence. And so what group violence intervention does is you use intelligence-led policing, you identify who's pulling the trigger, you actually call them into a room, a neutral venue like this, and you give them a carrot or stick option. And I'll tell you, the folks at John Jay don't like carrot or stick. That's not a term. I'm from the country. We'll use carrot or stick, not incentive or disincentive. And you give these folks an option, and it works. You give them the option of significant enforcement. If a trigger is pulled, we'll go after the entire organization. Or we'll give you an off-ramp. Whether that is you need a hotel room out of this neighborhood for a period of time to stop the retributive violence. In certain cases, diapers, job training, mental health, the whole panoply of social service options. You have pastors in the room talking to these folks. You have moms who've lost kids. But you also have cops and prosecutors saying, if you pull the trigger, we're coming for you. And so there's a significant enforcement piece to this. And it works. It works because you've seen the numbers drop dramatically once these call-ins start, once this engagement begins. We're not there yet in Louisville. COVID slowed this down. I'll tell you, we're doing it in Louisville, and it's privately funded. You want to talk about philanthropists leaning in? It's funded by the business community. If you live in Louisville or you spend time there, you know what this city's endured. This is not being funded by public sector dollars. It's being funded by the business community that's seeing our city, your city, state's largest, bleed out. So we're not there yet in terms, we haven't done these call-ins yet. COVID slowed us down. And quite frankly, internecine struggles within the administration in Louisville have slowed this down. But we're getting there. And the reason that, one of the reasons I'm so grateful and privileged to talk to you all is to mention what we're doing so that you know this acronym. And April, you've read the book. Read the book. Pay attention to what's going on in Louisville. Many of you aren't from Jefferson County, but there's no wall around Jefferson County. Louisville is a net exporter of violence to the remainder of your commonwealth, mostly in the central part of the state to the west. Much of the violence we see has a nexus to Louisville. The dope we see, the needles going into arms with fentanyl, a lot of it, particularly in central Kentucky and western Kentucky, comes from Louisville. So what goes on in Louisville is relevant to the rest of the state. So group violence intervention, GVI, the book is called Don't Shoot. The other piece of criminal justice reform that I want to briefly reference that is potentially, I think, more relevant to our conversation today is also out of a sense of failure, and that is 2020 in Louisville, Kentucky. We saw not only we saw the homicide numbers, I mean, we had the highest number of homicides last year in the history of Louisville, and last year, 173, almost 600 Louisvillians shot. Little girls like Trinity Randolph, 3-year-old, in her Disney coffin. I stood in front of the coffin with her mom. Disney coffin was killed in her playhouse. Retributive violence. Her father was killed. She was killed for good measure. Her shooter was also released on home incarceration, by the way, until the feds picked him up. So as we talk criminal justice reform, let's dig in and be very clear as to what we're discussing, because some of this makes us much less safe, and some of it has a positive impact. A sense of failure, not only in terms of violent crime, but you couldn't look through a window without it, seeing it boarded up in downtown Louisville. Did any of y'all go to downtown Louisville in 2020? Can I see a show of hands of anyone who has spent time at downtown Louisville, Judge? I know you know what I'm talking about. Not only the plates of glass, but just the heaviness. I mean, your state's largest city, whether you're a fan of Louisville or not, it is an economic engine. It does provide great value to the rest of this Commonwealth. And whether you care about what goes on in Louisville because the state seal shows urban and rural shaking hands because you give a damn because these are our neighbors, or you care about what goes on in Louisville because it does export violence to and drugs to the rest of the Commonwealth, it is important that you track what goes on there. And I'll tell you, the relationships between law enforcement and the black community, the wheels came off in 2020 in Louisville. Relationships are built one brick at a time. Well, those were busted down in 2020. Relationships, information flow from neighborhoods that were impacted to law enforcement dried up. Relationships completely burned down. So I'll say that the one issue that continues to be raised, was raised with me time after time as U.S. Attorney, other than the fact that why aren't you doing more to save our kids? And that's oftentimes looking in the eyes of those that have lost their kids. It is an issue that while the speaker couldn't cite the exact provision of 18 U.S.C., but the fact that we continue to treat powder cocaine and crack cocaine with a significant sentencing disparity, 18 to 1 is where we've landed after some degree of reform. Again, the speaker wouldn't cite the specific provision, but time and time again, this issue was raised because of the significant disparity. And I'll tell you, we don't see cocaine cases anymore in Louisville. It is a rare day that we see a powder cocaine case. Conversations with folks here in your district, judge, prosecutors, drug task force, not only here but across the country, there was a time when we, and I said powder cocaine, I meant crack cocaine. There was a time when violence was driven significantly by crack cocaine. And although some may criticize why that disparity existed to begin with, looking at the legislative history, what I saw was a sense of fear, much like the challenge we're facing now with fentanyl. And Congress created a significant sentencing disparity that, again, over time has been pared down to 18 to 1. But the fact that there is that disparity between powder and crack cocaine continues to be raised time and time again by folks in the black community as a limiting factor to relationship. And I will tell you, as I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, I wouldn't be sitting there. In no circumstance would I be advocating for eliminating mandatory minimums. Would I be advocating for backing off some of these significant sentencing tools that you need? But what I testified and what I support and what passed the House of Representatives overwhelmingly, the entire Kentucky delegation voted for it, was to eliminate that disparity from now 18 to 1, to resolve it to be a 1-to-1 sentencing disparity. We are at a time when we need one brick at a time to build back the relationships between law enforcement and the black community. the community that's primarily impacted by violent crime. Again, I wouldn't have been sitting in that chair talking about fentanyl. I wouldn't have been sitting in that chair talking about any substance that was still driving our challenges. But it was fighting yesterday's war. And so while there could be some criticism, I've already been gigged for being on the panel that's all about letting out criminals. That's not what we're talking about here, but we are talking about a crisis in this country where law enforcement and the black community, there is a chasm. And so if we can take a step to create parity in a substance that is not driving our challenges now, given the exigency of our challenges in places like Louisville, then I'm all in. And so that's why someone who was blessed to be an aggressive prosecutor was supporting what's known as the Equal Act, again, passed the House a couple of weeks ago, overwhelmingly. Everything we do, and I'll end with this, every provision, every tweak, every discussion needs to start and it needs to end on what impacts public safety. What impacts recidivism? Does it enhance or is it a failure? And so that's the lens that we should view criminal justice reform. With that, thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, everybody. Can you hear me all right? So my focus here today is just to talk a little bit about what reform looks like from the perspective of a prosecutor. As Judge Thapar noted, I've been an assistant U.S. attorney for 15 years. Most recently, for the last 3 years, I've been the supervisor of the U.S. Attorney's Office up in Northern Kentucky, which might seem like far away from Louisville, but a lot of the same problems that Russell talked about we face not only in the Eastern District, but in Northern Kentucky as well. But prior to that, I was a line criminal AUSA for 12 years and got to have the most fun, I think, of anybody in the Department of Justice. And so what I'm going to talk about today, I apologize in advance that my perspective might be limited. So if there are any state court prosecutors in the audience, again, I apologize. But what I'm going to talk about is what reform looks like, federal reform looks like for federal criminal prosecutors. And just the idea of criminal justice reform made me think about how I had been implementing the reform over the course of my 15-year career. And what's funny is I hadn't really given it much thought because as a line criminal AUSA, my marching orders were pretty clear. Whatever the policy of the U.S. Attorney was, and more importantly, whatever the policy of the Department of Justice through the Attorney General was, I was instructed to implement it. And so whatever it was, that's what I did. I think it's important to talk a little bit about some of the maybe misconceptions or ideas of what criminal justice reform looks like in other areas of the law versus federal criminal justice reform. States, for example, have implemented and established conviction integrity units. I'm sure everybody has heard about innocence projects being stood up and being affiliated with local law schools. I don't know if anybody is a fan of true crime podcasts, but we have criminal justice reform is everywhere. I think at this point we even have public figures, celebrities, bringing certain cases to the forefront for reexamination. But thankfully, I'm very appreciative of this, our federal reform is a very different flavor. As both Judge Reeves and Russell alluded to, it's generally sort of two varieties. It's either legislative coming out of Congress or it's sentencing commission driven. Either way, it's born out of consensus. And that is something that is wholly different than some of the reform that you'll see at the state level. Obviously, as a Department of Justice employee, I'm not appointed, I'm not elected, I'm just there to do my job every day. And so it took me a minute to think about the fact that I have been for 15 years part of this reform. But I am, again, very appreciative that the reform that I am part of has been the result of consensus. And that's important because the benefits are tremendous. That type of reform, it's not fleeting. It's not tied to an individual person. It's across the board. And at least for the Department of Justice, it's consistent in application. And so for folks who are worried about restoring relationships, restoring integrity, that at least gives me some solace that what we're doing is fair, it's equal, and it's consistent in application to all of the defendants across the country who are being prosecuted federally. The downside to some of the reform that we've seen coming out of Congress is that, selfishly, the shelf life of criminal cases is a lot longer than it's ever been. I started as a prosecutor in 2006. I'm not sure I even saw my first habeas or post-conviction motion for 5 or 6 years. At this point, we are seeing just an abundance and some very creative post-conviction motions filed by pro se defendants. And sometimes we're even, some of our defendants, once their convictions are final, post-conviction motions are being litigated not once, but sometimes twice, depending on if there's been an intervening change in the law and whether that change is constitutional in nature and thus retroactive. And so the downside, there's tremendous upside to the benefits of criminal justice reform that are ongoing in the federal system, but there's also a little bit of downside. But for folks who have spent their career in the Department of Justice, that's not too much of a downside. It might be apparent to some, most, all of you today, but there's some pretty obvious reasons why there's these differences between criminal justice reform at the state level and what I see at the federal level. First, there's really just two factors. The first is the types of cases that are prosecuted. At the state level, you know, as Russell sort of alluded to with the tumult that was going on down in Louisville, you have lots of crimes against people. So you've got homicides of all different kinds. You've got rapes, all sorts of crimes against people. That's not to say that's not part of federal criminal practice. It is, but it's a much smaller part. Primarily the types of cases that I and my office prosecute, again, as Russell alluded to, drug crimes have been and continue to be probably the biggest number of cases that my office prosecutes currently. Along with that are gun crimes, federal firearms crimes, a wide variety of fraud, wire bank mail fraud, tax fraud, all of those sorts of crimes, immigration, and crimes against children or child pornography. So when you consider the types of cases that are prosecuted at the state level and the federal level, I think that's one reason why the reform looks a little bit different. The second, and probably the bigger reason why reform looks different, is just how cases are resolved. I think the Sentencing Commission's most recent data from fiscal year 2020, and it analyzed cases across the country, not only by district, by each federal judicial district, but also by circuit. And not one circuit had a guilty plea rate under 95%. So across the board, across the country, 95% or more of federal cases that are prosecuted resolve by way of guilty plea. I think I looked at our Eastern, the numbers in the Eastern District, and we're just right at about that number. I think it was 95.7. So when you consider the types of cases that are prosecuted at the state and federal level, and then more importantly, how those cases are resolved, I think it's pretty easy to see why reform looks a little bit different and why the reform in the federal court is, again, more based on the result of consensus, either by Congress or the Sentencing Commission. I do want to touch briefly on, before I talk about what reform looks like for a prosecutor and what we have to do on a daily basis to implement that reform. There has been some other reform. Some other reform with respect to law enforcement. So as prosecutors, we have a number of different interests that we try to balance. Not one is more important than the other, but we certainly get all of our cases from federal law enforcement agencies, so we work hand-in-hand with law enforcement. Sometimes our cases involve victims, whether it's child pornography cases, fraud cases, even cases that involve crimes of violence. We have victims also. Believe it or not, we also work a lot with defense counsel here in the Eastern District. We try to make sure that that relationship is collaborative and transparent and open, and we're all on the same page working towards the same goal of making sure that whatever happens, sometimes we don't want the same thing to happen. We just want to make sure that what we're all aiming towards is for the right thing to happen. And that right thing to happen, for whatever that right thing is, usually informed by whatever the law is. But we have had some recent reform that has touched law enforcement specifically, and I just want to talk about three in particular, one of which does impact on a daily basis the role of prosecutors. As opposed to the sort of consensus-based reform that prosecutors are asked to implement, the reform recently for law enforcement, federal that is really policy-driven. And it's probably policy-driven because of a lot of the things that Russell talked about, things that are trying to be repaired and rehabilitated over the last couple of years. One primary element of that reform recently is that federal law enforcement agencies now are going to be wearing body-worn cameras. Some might say that the feds are usually a little bit late to the game, and that might be true in this instance as well. State and local law enforcement have been wearing body cameras for quite some time. The federal agencies are on board as well now. But that particular issue for prosecutors raises a whole host of issues, because when you think about what can be captured on a body cam, it literally checks, that footage can check literally every box that a prosecutor, state or federal, has to be cognizant of before a case is even presented to the grand jury for indictment. We're talking about things like discovery, the things that we're required to produce under Rule 16 to defendants and defense counsel that we're going to use as part of our evidence. Oftentimes, body-worn camera also implicates other obligations that we have to be cognizant of under the Jenks Act, statements by certain witnesses, or Giglio, potential impeachment information, or material related to our witnesses. And then finally, it also could implicate Brady, so potentially exculpatory material. So that that one particular element of reform, even though it's specifically tailored to and impacts law enforcement, absolutely does have a tremendous impact on the way that prosecutors are doing their jobs daily. We've had a couple other recent reforms, policy-based reforms for law enforcement in the federal system as well. Recently, there's been generally, there are going to be some exceptions to the rule, prohibitions on no-knock warrants, and another prohibition on certain types of physical restraint. The main thing that I really wanted to talk about, Judge Reeves has already sort of alluded to, and those were the changes that were implemented in the law, sort of two parts. First, pursuant to the Fair Sentencing Act of 2012, and then further with the First Step Act of 2018. The First Step Act was probably the most significant area of criminal justice reform that we've seen as prosecutors in the last couple of years. And there's lots of important provisions. Some the public probably isn't even aware of. Some, frankly, even most prosecutors aren't even aware of. But one of the first elements of the First Step Act related to, I think, the theme of Judge Reeves' presentation, and that's recidivism. So the first part of the First Step Act that addressed that was to promote recidivist reduction programs. And essentially what the First Step Act requires is a collaborative effort between the Attorney General, the Bureau of Prisons, and what's called an IRC, an Independent Review Committee. And basically what this is tailored to do is it requires those groups to come up with and do sort of a risk and needs assessment for each individual inmate and sort of tailor empirical evidence and empirically based programs and activities that inmates can do so that they can ultimately earn time off their sentences. It's called time credit. That's not something that prosecutors in my office or even as a line that I have a whole lot of interaction with, unless I see a defendant who's petitioning the court for some kind of release and has indicated to the court that they've had that risk assessment done. But other than that, it's not something that prosecutors really have really that much of a hand in. What is probably the most impactful to the AUSA's job is really the meat of the First Step Act, and that is that's the changes that Judge Reeves alluded to, the amendments that were made to the statutory sentencing provisions. And it really touched two primary, two of the biggest, probably the biggest, titles in the U.S. Code that AUSAs are charged with prosecuting cases under Title 21, which generally covers most all of the drug crimes that we prosecute, and then Title 18, which is where the majority of the crimes are that we prosecute, where they are memorialized. But let's start with Title 21. And the changes that the First Step Act made to Title 21 were twofold. For most drug offenses, you're going to have penalties that are a combination of two factors: the type of drug that's involved and the quantity of that drug. Those two things are going to inform the penalty that Congress has prescribed. Sometimes there's a floor in terms of a mandatory minimum that Congress has prescribed. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes there's just a ceiling. But what the First Step, even prior to the First Step Act, each one of the penalty provisions that applies to federal drug crimes, it had sort of a baseline penalty, and then it had an enhanced penalty. And those enhanced penalties applied across the board to defendants in all three of the different tiers of penalties that Title 21 has, if a defendant had a prior qualifying felony drug offense. Well, what the First Step Act did was sort of tighten the prior convictions that will qualify to trigger those enhanced penalties. So for the two categories of the most serious penalties that were applicable under Title 21, that term, that phrase felony drug offense, has now been replaced with serious drug felony. And that's a much more difficult, burden's the wrong word to use, it's just a tighter, it's just a more serious prior conviction that has to be proved. It essentially eliminated any chance that just a straight possession prior could be used to enhance a defendant's sentence under Title 21. It also added a new type of prior that can be used to justify those enhanced penalties. So in addition to serious drug felonies, we also have a new category of priors that can count, and those are serious violent felonies. So if a defendant has either one of those two types of convictions, if the defendant served more than 12 months for any of those prior convictions and was released from any term of imprisonment within 15 years of committing the crime that they're charged with, then those priors will count, and a defendant will now be subject to enhanced penalties. The First Step Act, though, in addition to changing what priors counted, it also changed what the penalties actually were. So for the most serious drug offenses under federal law, those that involved, over 5 kilos of powder cocaine, over 280 grams of crack cocaine, over a kilo of heroin, over 500 grams of a mixture or substance, or 50 grams of actual methamphetamine. Now, prior to the First Step Act, those priors were really just, there were two tiers. If a defendant was charged with an offense involving any one of those drugs in that quantity, the floor was 10 years, and the ceiling was life. Now, what the First Step Act did, in addition to changing what priors could subject a defendant to enhanced penalties, it changed the penalties themselves. So it used to be just 10 to life. Now we have an intermediate penalty as well. So we have a floor of 10. If a defendant has one prior, that floor goes up to 15. If a defendant has two priors, that floor goes up to 25. And in those circumstances, the maximum potential penalty is always going to be life. The one other main area that the First Step Act changed, and again, it's the penalty, the penalties were changed, not so much anything else about the statute itself, related to 18 U.S. Code Section 924C. So whenever a defendant is charged under 924C, there's sort of two branches to this tree. It essentially criminalizes the possession of a firearm in furtherance of a crime of violence or in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense, or criminalizes using and carrying a firearm during and in relation to either one of those two types of offenses. And much like the drug penalties, Section 924C also has a mandatory minimum, a floor that the court cannot go under, absent a motion. And it also had another provision built in that if you had multiple prior, or multiple, if you had a prior, you could be subject to not only consecutive punishment, but a much higher enhanced punishment of 25 years. The First Step Act did away with that. It eliminated that the second part of the penalty structure, in that you can still have consecutive penalties, but the 25-year consecutive penalty no longer applies unless the defendant had a prior conviction that didn't come out of the same, basically the same indictment as the current 924C charge. Judge Reeves already talked about sort of the tension or the inconsistency between the safety valve that's memorialized in Title 18 that affords certain relief to defendants in drug cases. Nothing's happened from the Sentencing Commission in that respect, so we still have the Sentencing Commission's version of the safety valve versus Congress's, and that's going to continue to be a tension for the time being. But probably the most important thing that the First Step Act did was that it made the Fair Sentencing Act that was enacted in 2010 retroactive. And so for anybody who was a federal prosecutor during that time, it ended up being it was a bit of a labyrinth because we had effective dates of statutes, we had dates that crimes were committed, we had dates that a defendant was being sentenced on, and essentially where we stood prior to the enactment of the First Step Act was a defendant was got relief, got the benefit of those changes in the crack cocaine guidelines if they were sentenced after the Fair Sentencing Act became effective. What the First Step Act did was kind of come back, go back in time and say, even if you were sentenced prior to the 2010 Act, but your conduct implicates these new thresholds for crack cocaine, defendants are now able to petition the courts for relief as well. One more thing I'll touch on very quickly before I move on is something that Russell alluded to as well, and that is crime victims. We've talked about sort of what crime looks like for prosecutors, maybe what some of the concerns are for the public, but crime victims are often the forgotten part of that equation. We have had some significant, again, statutory reform that's addressed to and aimed at crime victims recently. One sort of category that's been consistent among the reform is that a lot of this reform has touched crimes against children, which is a big part of my practice, my office's practice. It continues to be a priority of DOJ. So while we don't generally prosecute hands-on offenses or sexual abuse of minors, we do prosecute the possession, the receipt, the transportation, the distribution, and the production of child pornography. And we have had some significant reform as of late, in 2015 and 18, that are specifically addressed to and tailored to victims in those types of cases. The main points of that reform are that we've got increased financial burdens that can be levied on defendants, whether it's in terms of additional special assessments or restitution that can now be afforded to victims of those particular types of crime. So in a nutshell, that is what I do on a daily basis. That's what the AUSAs who I supervise do. And until I was asked to be on this panel, I really hadn't given much thought to that's what I do on a daily basis, but I'm proud to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse.
So I spent about half my career as a federal prosecutor and about half doing white-collar criminal defense, and as a prosecutor, most of what I did was white-collar criminal prosecutions. So I feel like our white-collar defendants have been left out of this conversation, so you know they need some attention too. In the criminal justice reform discussion, there isn't much conversation recently about sentences for white-collar defendants, particularly defendants who fall at the higher end of the loss guidelines, which is a change. So for probably 10 or 15 years in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a lot of discussion about this issue. So what had happened was there has been sort of a one-way ratchet on loss amounts under the guidelines, and specific offense characteristics under the guidelines that have, you know, from the time the guidelines went into effect in the late 80s until now, really ratcheted up the guidelines recommended sentences for white-collar criminal defendants who are at the high ends of the guidelines. So we're talking, you know, at the high ends, you're talking the Madoffs and the Enrons and things like that. So obviously not a pool of people for whom, you know, there's generally a lot of sympathy, so you can understand why there haven't been sort of amelioration of these loss amounts. But it's really remarkable when you look at the data. What I think the statistic was about a $2.5 million crime in the late 1980s when the guidelines came into effect would result with, you know, when you try to make the specific offense characteristics line up, a $2.5 million crime in the late 1980s would have a recommended guideline sentence of 30 to 37 months. Under the current guidelines, it's 150 to 187 months. So there has been this sort of exponential increase, oftentimes following major frauds, major corporate frauds, in the guidelines that have very, very significantly increased the recommended sentences at the high ends of the guidelines. And so what you have is a combination of the increased penalties for loss amounts, and then also you have specific offense characteristics. So, for example, did this crime involve abuse of a position of trust or use of a special skill, or were there over a certain floor of victims? And essentially, in order to carry out one of these big high-dollar crimes, all of those characteristics have to be present, or else you wouldn't have been able to carry out the crime. But what the guidelines do is they apply both the higher loss amount and then hit you with the specific offense characteristics, which are already in some ways taken into account in the higher loss penalties. So you end up sort of double counting some of the same offense characteristics to again produce these 150 to 225 month ranges, 225 months, 360 months to life. You get these very, very, very high guidelines recommended ranges. And the problem, you know, we can argue whether that's an appropriate recommendation for a sentence or not, but I think what's more interesting is the fact that those sentences are almost never imposed. In reading the cases, it's sort of the judges bend over backwards to explain why we're not imposing this guideline sentence, because this guideline sentence is just so high and it doesn't make sense. So what you essentially have is a situation where the guidelines would point to one thing, and this is pre-Booker and post-Booker, and what the sentences give is something very, very different. And so in a way, it's almost like you're in a pre-guidelines world where you're just looking at the 3553A factors or just sort of what's the judge's evaluation of this particular crime. And you're divorcing the sentences from what the guidelines would point to. And then the question is, why is that a problem? Well, I think from a public policy perspective, these are the crimes that sometimes get the most attention, right? The Enrons or the Bernie Madoffs. And if we have a sentencing regime under which the guidelines would point to one thing, but the sentences are not only not tied to the guidelines, but are wildly disparate from each other, it defeats the whole purpose of the guidelines, which was to introduce some uniformity into sentencing practices so that you go into a courtroom in Kentucky and you go into a courtroom in California, all factors being equal, you're going to get about the same sentence. And that's just not something that we have anymore. If we ever did, we certainly don't have now in sort of the high value, high loss sentencings. One statistic I was reading in preparation for this, there was a statistical analysis of maybe 30 or 35 of these sort of high dollar prosecutions over the last maybe 10 or 15 years. And the loss amount per month in prison ranged at the low end from about $32,000 per month to, at the high end, $36 million per month. I mean, that's the range that we see in what does a certain amount of loss cost you in time of prison, which, you know, I think you could objectively look at that and say, yes, there are significant differences in a lot of these frauds, but is it a good thing for the way the public perceives the federal sentencing process to have sentences which are so wildly disparate from each other and then which look like they're at such a discount from the guideline ranges, and it kind of leaves the public to say, well, this just doesn't make sense, and then it leaves prosecutors and judges and defense attorneys. I mean, it's great for defense attorneys in some ways because you can argue, you know, for a very low sentence, but it leaves the federal criminal prosecution, sentencing, and judicial system in sort of a state where you don't know where to look for guidance. So just a plug for, as we talk about federal sentencing reform, that's, I think, something to think about. And recognizing that, look, that only applies to a tiny slice. I mean, 91% of the prison population is state. So we're only talking about 9% when we even talk about the guidelines world. And then when we talk about economic crimes, you know, that's maybe a third of federal prosecutions. And then we talk about the high-dollar economic crimes. That's just a tiny, tiny sliver. So this doesn't have, you know, day-to-day nuts and bolts impact on a lot of people. But I think for the perception of the federal sentencing process, it really actually does have an outsized impact.
We have time for a couple of questions.
Danny, yes. Would you do me two favors? Repeat the question and speak into the mic for the recording purposes.
All righty.
Thank you.
The question was age and its effect on recidivism, and I believe the question was, do the studies go into... Right. Well, sometimes I think we get the misperception that drug traffickers equate to drug users, and that's not always the case. The studies don't go into a lot of detail on that, but when we look at other studies, we see that people don't necessarily specialize in the type of drugs that they sell. Today's trafficker of crack cocaine is tomorrow's trafficker of methamphetamine, and probably more dangerously, fentanyl and the fentanyl analogs. We do know, for example, that individuals do change the type of drugs that they're selling. Sometimes they don't, but many times that they do. We talk a lot about crack cocaine, for example, and there's been a lot of criticism of the guidelines, but crack cocaine offenders and the number of prosecutions over the last 10 years has declined dramatically from about 6,000 10 years ago in the federal system to about 1,000 this past year, while methamphetamine offenders has increased up to about 7,500. So there's about 7.5 times as many people convicted of those offenses. Now, a lot of those offenders, those methamphetamine offenders that are trafficking are using methamphetamine. I would say probably the majority that we see, that's anecdotal, but the studies don't really report that. But I think it's also important when you consider these issues that you follow the money. And that's why I say be aware of fentanyl. Fentanyl prosecutions really started in 2015, 2016 in earnest, and fentanyl prosecutions have increased since that time, since to 2019, 3,592%. Analogs have increased 5,725%. And of the deaths that are attributed to drug overdoses, where you get a guideline enhancement for death or bodily injury, 75% are attributed to fentanyl or fentanyl analogs. Small percentage of cases, but the result is pretty staggering. In answer to your direct question, there's not a lot of study on that, but there are provisions in the guidelines that allow you to take that into account when a person is sentenced. So it certainly can be considered.
Thank you. One more. Yes.
My question is also for Judge Reeves. Judge, you said that 49.3% of people who are released will reoffend within 8 years.
Just either rearrested or they committed a violation of supervision. The most, for example, drug traffickers, you would think that that person would, the most common violation may be another drug trafficking offense. It's not. 20% are assaults. So they're violent offenses that are committed as well.
Okay, so that one
A violation of supervision, but it's an arrest rate. We're looking at rearrest when we study that recidivism factors. It's 49.3%. It's an 8-year study. Most persons on federal supervision are on supervision, and the violation usually occurs within 20 months. So some of those violations can certainly occur long after they've been released from supervision.
Okay. Please join me in thanking the panel. Remember, lunch is outside, and there's a great panel coming up next.